I think a lot of people just think it's a lot of men in suits that are going to be in a big room. Will they be able to get on? And you know, will something really, really productive and really world-changing come of it?
That was Pip Gerrard, and we'll hear more from them later in the show. Hello, and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malik, and on this episode, I'll be joined by Pip Gerrard and Scott Milne from DC Thompson's Environment and Transport team, Andy Phillip and Rachel Amory, to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest political stories, read to you by Morag Lindsay.
Pope Francis has called on political leaders heading to COP26 to urgently tackle the climate crisis to give concrete hope to future generations. The summit, taking place in Glasgow from Sunday, has no global treaty to agree, unlike the last major UN climate conference in Paris in 2015. But it is being described as the conference that must deliver on the Paris Agreement and its key pledge to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius or 1.5 degrees Celsius to avoid the worst impacts of global warming. Britain has warned the UK could retaliate if France goes ahead with inflammatory threats made in a post-Brexit row over fishing rights. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss will challenge Paris's ambassador to the UK, Catherine Colonna, on France's intentions on Friday after taking the rare step of ordering an allied nation's envoy to be summoned. One UK trawler has been detained in a French port in an escalation of a diplomatic row triggered by France's claim there is a shortage of licences for its boats to fish in UK waters. Former UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown has called on Western leaders to make a decision to provide the world's poorest and most vulnerable people with COVID vaccines. Mr. Brown was among a group including former UN General Secretary Ban Ki-moon and ex-New Zealand Premier Helen Clark, who called for world leaders to send unused vaccines from the global north to the global south and keep vaccination targets on track.
Thanks, Morag. Right, let's turn our attention to what has been happening closer to home. This week we had the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, unveil the spending and taxation plans, also known as the annual budget. Andy, you've been having a look at that for us this week, as have I, as has Rachel. Andy, talk us through, is it good news, bad news, indifferent news for Scotland? Are we getting a big lump of cash, or is it, as ever, a lot more complicated?
I wish it was as easy as just being given a big lump of cash. And that's certainly how the Chancellor pitched it. There's a big shiny pound sign in front of 4.6 billion, which he was saying that Scotland's going to get for spending. And in amongst all of that, there was some kind of eye-catching spending plans, which included the slightly controversial levelling up agenda, which gives loads of money for projects in Aberdeen, Inverness, Perth and Kinross, all kinds of community projects as well, funded directly from the UK government. But of course, 24 hours after the budget comes out, everyone has had a chance to sort of drill down into the details. And as with every year, groups like the Institute for Fiscal Studies and the government's sort of OBR as well, they look at the numbers, and the Institute for Fiscal Studies points out that actually, as well as all those nice price tags, millions of people will be worse off with rising costs, tax increases, although tax is now a lot more complicated because the Scottish Parliament has so much control over taxes here. But the cost of living is going up, inflation's going up, and so there's always a sting in the tail, and there's still a lot of warnings about how it will all pan out as we get towards Christmas and the New Year and winter.
So you mentioned a phrase there that's been quite popular over the past couple of weeks, levelling up. Not just a buzzword anymore, it's now an actual fund. Is that to replace the EU funding that a lot of local authorities up in Scotland have sort of taken advantage of over the last 10 years?
Yeah, so European Union money used to come in, and the Scottish government, Scottish Parliament would often badge that money up and allocate it how they saw fit. There obviously came a political problem when, after Brexit, the UK government said, well, we'll have our own fund now, our own way of allocating cash to replace this sort of gap. But that meant it was an opportunity for the UK government to say, well, why are we just handing over the money? Why don't we you know, put our own stamp on this? What's to stop us funding projects directly in every part of the UK? Now, I think it's fair to say that most people don't particularly care where the money comes from. They just want things to be better. They want, you know, from the most mundane potholes to be fixed to the biggest things like, you know, Aberdeen City Centre getting a polish. Of course, the Scottish Parliament also points out that a lot of these things are in their control, for example, infrastructure, roads, and there's a little bit of political jostling, you know, get your tanks off our lawn kind of thing. But that's essentially what levelling it up is, and our man Michael Gove has got that in his job title as well.
That's his latest job title?
Yeah, among the other ones.
Is he still Duchy of Lancaster?
He's point man for the union, and he's levelling up guru, and I'm not sure what else. I've lost track now. He's got a long job title. He's a Tory MP.
Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Is that what Boris is doing? 3 pence off a pint, though. That can't be too bad, can it?
Not to be stiffed at.
No, although I did see someone work out that with all the different national insurance contributions raises, you're going to have to drink 200 pints a day for that to make any effect.
Well, that could be next week's show.
Watch as we try and win money back off the government by drinking 200 pints.
Yeah, why not?
Rachel, was there any standout moments from the budget for you?
One thing that I did think about was the tax on domestic flights, actually. That's one thing that's really sort of divided people. So if you are going on a domestic flight within the UK by 2023, your air duty tax will be halved. Now, places like Aberdeen Airport, for example, they rely quite heavily on domestic flights, and that was obviously completely decimated during the pandemic. And so they're really happy. They say that this new tax cut will help ease some of that burden. And the Scottish Chamber of Commerce as well, they say it's a ray of hope for the aviation sector. But I'm sure you can probably imagine environmental campaigners, the SNP as well, say that it's completely damaging and it really sends the wrong signal, especially as it's only hours to go until COP26, the UN climate change summit, happens in Glasgow. So there's very much toing and throwing over that. Greenpeace, for example, they're saying the government are making climate change worse by doing something like that. Ian Blackford, he's the leader of the SNP at Westminster, as a disgrace was the word that he used, and said that the government doesn't understand how serious the climate emergency is if they're going to do something like this. One thing that they did do as well with air tax duty was they introduced an ultra long haul band for flights that were over 5,500 miles. But if we actually just put that into context, that would be like flying from here all the way to Brazil directly. I mean, that's a long, long flight that not a lot of people are going to be doing. It's only about 5% of passengers that's actually going to affect. So I think that was quite an important one, just because of the environmental conference starting this weekend.
You've touched upon something that we will be talking about later in the show with our environment and transport teams there in the air passenger duty reduction. For young people, they seem to get left behind on the wage increase, Rachel. I don't know if you've seen that over 23s are getting an increase to the national living wage, or the national minimum wage, as it used to be called, and it's not being raised for young people who seem to have been affected more by the pandemic. Is this something that you think will become a bit of a sticking point in the future, or do the Conservatives not really care that much because nobody under the age of 24 seems to vote for them anyway?
Yes, that's one of the things that the government was very much wanting to push, is the sort of the big shiny new thing that they were introducing this week for the budget. I think a lot of people who are on minimum wage jobs who are under the age of 23 will be very unhappy with this. When I was a teenager, I was working in McDonald's, serving burgers and chicken nuggets to you fine people, and that was minimum wage, and it was quite frustrating to know that just because I was 18, I was earning less than the person next to me. So I think people who are in that situation will be very disappointed to know that they're going to have to wait potentially a good few years before that will affect them.
I mean, I know that's something I remember. I worked full time after leaving uni at 21, and was paid significantly less than someone who was 24, and it made zero sense to me at the time. Andy, there's been a lot of reflection in quite a lot of the papers this week. Some of the more traditional Tory papers have said that this is the Chancellor avoiding tax raises. Another few papers and another few Political thinkers have said that they've stolen one of Gordon Brown's old budgets. How do you think this is going to play out in the long term? Is this going to be considered one of the great conservative budgets, or has Rishi Sunak's hand been forced by the pandemic and the need to build back the economy, not just from COVID, but from Brexit too?
Yeah, I mean, these things they're quite fleeting. I mean, he was given quite a warm reception from his own side, and I think half the time, you know, conservatives in government, it's often the people behind the front line that they've got to look out for most, but they all seem pretty pleased. I my eyes nearly fell out of my head when I saw folk like Murdo Fraser, Conservative MSP, saying that he was a little bit in love with Rishi Sunak, which he's just left lingering there for us all to think about. But yeah, there was lots in it, but there's still a long way to go between now and the next budget. And, you know, it's kind of taken the flak a little bit away from the government for now, because, I mean, you don't have to look that far back to think about how we were talking about the energy crisis, HGV drivers, petrol pump, queues around the block. We could be back to that before you know it. Plus, you know, there's a pandemic that's not going away, even though a lot of people are acting as if it has. So I think you'd be a brave person to sort of plan ahead the next months for the government based on that one budget, I think.
And of course, we still have the large issue of the universal credit uplift being taken away. That's still a huge issue for people outside of the government. The opposition, Labour, still raising it, and indeed the Scottish government still concerned about how that's going to impact on people, Andy, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's what the sort of economists and experts and other think tanks and charities and support groups were saying a day after. The universal credit taper is getting cut, which brings it down, but just a few weeks ago we were still arguing about the fact that it was essentially being cut anyway. You know, the uplift, which was supposed to be temporary, has gone away, but as everybody apart from the Conservative government really pointed out, the actual costs associated with everything around us has not been cut at the same time. So this sort of temporary uplift is now gone, and a lot of people are wondering how they're going to pay the bills in the run-up to Christmas and through winter.
And Rachel, the Speaker of the House, Lindsay Hoyle, said that former chancellors maybe would have walked had they leaked so much of their budget to the press ahead of presenting it to members of Parliament. Rachel, there seems to be quite a tight turnaround as to when MPs get given sight of the budget at first and how they're supposed to respond. They get quite a lot of criticism for having an auto-response. Do you think it's about time that the budget wasn't done so ceremoniously and it was produced more realistically and fit for the 21st century, so that we could get advanced sight, that people could get advanced sight, that MPs could get advanced sight, and then they could tailor their responses accordingly rather than just going off that it's going to be bad because they're in an opposition position?
Yeah, sometimes with the budget, because it is so sort of ceremonious, as you were saying, it can be difficult to watch it and hear all the numbers and really understand how this affects the person sitting at home, doesn't it? So maybe it would be a good thing if there was more time for people to really sort of dig down to the nitty-gritty numbers and find out exactly what it means for people before we sort of go into that debate. It's certainly something to think about, absolutely.
I know I'd rather have advanced sight of it, just so that when you're asked opinions about it at home time on budget day, that I actually know what I'm talking about, rather than just, we'll have to wait and see. It does seem a bit odd that in the internet era that we do have to wait almost 24 hours for real analysis and responses to be given that such a large and influential piece that we hear from in the Commons every year. Andy, are you going to go down to the Beatles Museum in Liverpool when it's built? Is this a bit of smoke and mirrors from the government here? I mean, do the Beatles really need another museum in Liverpool?
I wasn't expecting to think about musical tourism as well. I think that if they build it, I will come. But I'm not really particularly sure whether that's on my travel agenda at the moment.
You can't buy me love, but you can maybe buy me a few votes. Rachel, you touched upon something that the Conservative member for West Aberdeenshire and Kincardineshire, Andrew Bowie, raised pre-budget. It looks like his wish came true that we are cutting airport passenger duty or duty return tax, which seems a bit odd given that COP26 starts this weekend and domestic flights seem to be bearing the brunt of the blame for the rise in CO2 emissions or whatever it is they're measuring the latest doom figures in. A bit hypocritical in some parts of the SNP though, no? Considering this is a policy that they've been calling for some time, as well as the option of a third runway at Heathrow. I suppose there is a fine line that you have to cut between making sure that people can get to Scotland easily enough and making sure that the world doesn't just combust into some sort of ball of fire.
Yeah, I do wonder how much quicker planes and trains between London and Scotland are, for example. I mean, I think there's only about 15 minutes, half an hour difference between the train and the plane by the time you take in getting through security and getting on and off the plane and everything. So, I mean, in terms of timings, I don't actually know if planes to London are that much quicker. So perhaps maybe there is a way of encouraging more people to take something like the train up. Obviously, we then get a bit more difficult when we're trying to get the train up as far as Inverness or Aberdeen, obviously. So maybe those in the northern areas of Scotland might think differently to that.
It's a nightmare getting the train from Aberdeen to London. It takes forever and it's, you know, it's not electric. As soon as you get to Edinburgh, it just feels like everything just grinds to a halt. And, you know, there's no wonder that Aberdeen Airport were delighted at the APD cut. And, you know, business, it's no surprise that people were so happy that it might be a bit cheaper to get from Aberdeen to London by flight. But, I mean, if the government and the Scottish government in particular as well are, you know, want to actually get people to think the way they're thinking or want us to behave, then there's going to have to be, I mean, what's been happening with the trains in the past few months, it's been an absolute horror show. And if you can't rely on, you know, something as simple as, well, will there be anything to eat or drink? Will there be catering? Will there be Wi-Fi that works? All these things. And is it going to take me 9 hours? I mean, it's no wonder that people will still try and find the easiest way of travelling.
And first and foremost, I think, when it comes to the train or the plane, is the cost.
Oh, yeah.
It's substantially cheaper to fly most of the time, even from somewhere like Dundee, than it is to get the train these days. Pip, if you wouldn't mind joining in on this, welcome to the Sushi. I know that we're going to talk a little bit about your journey across the north ahead of COP26 in an electric vehicle, but as a member of the Environment and Transport team for the Press and Journal, how underserved really is the Northeast when it comes to train services? And is that why it's been quite an easy win for the government to reduce air passenger duty?
Well, some parts are hugely underserved. You know, I think it's Peterhead and Fraserburgh are the largest places in the UK, the largest towns that don't have a train station. And so all the way up that route is just, you know, a real barren zone for trains. So if you live there, it's really, really difficult. Just from personal experience, it's the cost that puts you off even more than the actual effort of doing it, you know, of traveling to get to whatever your nearest train station is. So
it's extortion. I remember 10 years ago, I was going up to Elgin from Dundee on the train and it was £50 return. I shudder to think what it is now because your £40 return a day from Dundee to Edinburgh. And I know you can book advance tickets, but not everyone's got the wherewithal or the ability to, or even knows how far in advance they're going to be travelling to get, you know, between two major cities. Even Aberdeen to Dundee is extortionate on the train. It does make your head shake. And as you pointed out, Andy, we've had no trains on Sundays for the last 8 or 9 months. And it only seems that the disaster has been averted from no trains over COP26 because it's going to embarrass the Scottish government rather than actually wanting to make the changes for public transport. Now, Pip, you have just taken part in the first leg of a DC Thompson-wide journey where you jumped in an electric vehicle and you saw how difficult or how easy it was to traverse across the Northeast and Highlands in an electric car. Can you talk us through a bit of that journey? How easy was it, first of all? Was it as easy as you assumed it would be, or was it more difficult than planned to take an electric car from... Where did you start off, for example?
Well, I guess to start with, it was actually an electric van.
Okay.
So it was a Toyota Proace, so it was slightly bigger. So we were like white van men for the week, which was fun. Yeah, it was really funny because we got the specs through for the van a few days before. And it said that they had a range of 205 miles. That was its maximum range. If you don't use the radio, if you don't have the headlights on, if you use nothing else, it's 205 miles. So we're like, okay, suppose we can deal with that. It doesn't seem like a lot, but you know, maybe we can get to Inverness. Got in the van, fully charged, 136 miles was the biggest, the maximum range. And that was it. It had been charging overnight. So this was, you know, and it's a brand new van. We were the first people to use it. So already we were a little bit on the back foot thinking, okay, where are we going to charge? We're not going to make it to Inverness. So the official road trip for the DC Thompson road to Glasgow that we were doing, it started in John O'Groats, but we picked the van up in Aberdeen. So we had to get from Aberdeen to John O'Groats first. Then officially begin the trip the following day. So it was a bit hairy getting to John O'Groats, I have to say. And we drove through all of the weather, stopped in, I think, pretty much every major town or city that was on the route up there. So we left Aberdeen, left our houses at 9 a.m, picked up the van, got to John O'Groats at 8 p.m. in the evening. And it was honestly very hairy because we were staying in the only hotel. And their restaurant stopped serving dinner at 8:30. So it was a real race against time. We went to get there for dinner because otherwise we were going to starve. So we actually began the trip the next day in John O'Groats. So this was the official day one, I guess, there.
What are charging facilities like up there? Is it, are there a lot, or is it leaves a lot to be desired?
I'd say they're pretty sparse. There's huge areas that have nothing at all, just in like the middle of Scotland. And of course, that's where we were going because I'd arranged to do a story on the Peatlands, the Flow Country, which is in Caithness and Sutherland. And obviously that's a massive peat bog. So to be fair, you probably wouldn't expect to have EV chargers in a peat bog, but it did just so happen that we were going to like probably... Well, we were trying to look on a map and it seemed like it was probably the furthest place in the UK from a charger. We did make it though. So we went from John O'Groats to the middle of Caithness and Sutherland and then drove through to Helmsdale, where Helmsdale had one rapid charger, which was, it charged quickly, but the unexpected thing was it was kind of in the corner of a car park and you had to park on the pavement to get to it, which wasn't ideal. So we had to write a note because, you know, the next thing would be like the only policeman in Helmsdale was going to come along and give us a fine for parking on the pavement, which would not have been ideal. But that was really something.
So just a case of local authorities not thinking these things through, just a little, you know, when you park your car up, is that a case because the cable wasn't long enough to get from the charger to the car, or just the position of the input in the car?
Well, it was the cable really, because I mean, although we had a van, I don't even think this would have charged like a Nissan Leaf or like a little car that could have just driven straight up because it was just in a really weird position. And that's something that we kind of found, you know, the infrastructure was a bit weird. All the machines are different. They all have their little foibles that, you know, you need to plug it in and out three times before it's going to work. Or, you know, you basically need to call up the Charge Place Scotland or whoever runs that machine and they'll reset it for you and it will magically work. And all we can think is that they're pressing like control alt delete in some like big computer somewhere and then suddenly it works, but then other ones don't work at all and it's really random and you just don't know until you get there, because there is a map called Zap Map that we were using to like track where we were going to go and where we were going to charge, but it wasn't exactly accurate all the time. Sometimes it said it didn't work when it did, sometimes it said it was in use when it wasn't. And then, you know, the opposite would also happen. So we would rock up and expect it to be there and someone was already charging. So then we're stuck.
You noted earlier that you were given a range of how many miles you would be able to do, and then it was different as you switched the car on or turned the car on or whatever the process is around that. But you have to do without all of the mod cons, no radio, no aircon, no heating. Is that pretty much out to eke as many miles out of the battery as you could?
Yep. So we actually took, my colleague Kieran had a brainwave and took a portable speaker with us, because I'd driven an electric car before and knew that the radio and stuff can actually really drain the battery, and apparently heated seats are the worst things. They just like flatten the battery like that. But our van was a bit more basic, so we didn't have heated seats to worry about. But we were driving on eco mode, so there was like different modes that you could select. So normal was just as a normal car, as you would expect. Eco mode, initially we weren't sure what it did, but we were driving in it anyway just to be extra conservative with our miles. And it turns out that one day we were just driving along freezing wearing three jumpers, because eco mode meant that there's no heating or nothing works like on the interior of the van, except you just drive and that's all you get. So we were like gumming up the windows because there was no air coming through, no heating. So it was a really big learning curve.
It sounds like the actual Wild Wild West.
That's what I felt like at times when it was a bit hairy.
A road less travelled. Now let's see if we can grab Scott Milne, who is currently on the road to Glasgow for COP26.
Hello.
Hi Scott, how are you doing? You're live on the Stooshy this morning. Please don't swear or use any curse words. I believe that you've picked up the second leg of the journey to COP26 and Glasgow using an electric vehicle. And we know from previous stories that you've written that you've had your hands singed by the charger before and you aren't the biggest fan. How's your journey to Glasgow this week changed your mind?
Yeah, so we were in an electric van. I took over from the Press and Journal guys. Colleagues in the Press and Journal were driving from Drunadost to Aberdeen. I took over at Aberdeen and I took it down to Forfar, and then we started our stint at the journey then. EV infrastructure is definitely an issue, shall we say. It's a whole new set of challenges working out how far you can get, and that becomes a whole thing, because it tells you you've got 100 miles in the clock, but it doesn't, of range, but you've driven 20 miles and 50 miles have been depleted. And a lot of that's because of driving fast on the dual carriageways, and that it doesn't like driving particularly fast. You come up to charge points and you're very lucky if they work. They sometimes look like they're going to work, but then conk out in the last minute. I've had cables plugged into chargers that just will not disconnect. I've had different apps that have not got clear instructions. It's a stressful thing driving around for, anyway sometimes, but this is a whole new level. I think I've added a few years to my life, or reduced a few years to my life, just in the strain on my heart, making it to different places at different times, because we're meeting people, obviously, set up things, and we're going to be letting them down by running late. So it's definitely been an adventure.
Great stuff, Scott. I think that there's a lot of stuff that needs to be ironed out, and thank you for joining us this week. That was Scott Milne. Thanks for joining us on the road there. Andy, one of the more popular stories that we've had on our website regarding COP26 has been the use of large generators being transported across the country to charge the electric vehicles that dignitaries are going to be in. They seem to have crept back up again after it would appear that the lovely smell of biodiesel is affecting the good people of Glasgow's nose and senses in general. Andy, do you think we're about to slip on a big banana skin in terms of how the world sees us, or is this just usual media hype before a very well-received event?
First Minister's questions yesterday kind of gave us another idea of how it's being viewed and how the politicians are using it. The Scottish Government trying very hard to make this about a small country on a world stage, kind of trying to show what it can do. But the opposition, quite rightly, holding them to account on all the many, many years of promises that have been made and, highfalutin targets that haven't actually been met. But it all comes down to the sort of rather humdrum sounding fight over whether or not Glasgow's got a bins problem. We couldn't sort out the trains. I mean, these are all huge issues domestically. And it kind of, on one hand, it shows up just the basic problems with administrating a city, you know, how do you get from A to B? And on the other side, it also kind of pricks a bit of the ego when it, you know, if the first minister wants to stand on the stage and be listened to while all world leaders are coming here talking about what we're doing, it's not good to have to fight a rear guard action because, you know, Glasgow City Council's up to its neck in a row with the refuse collectors, people going on strike. A couple of the things that we mentioned before, like train strikes, they may have been averted, but again, and picking up from the electric van experience, you know, every time people try and do the right thing, you're reminded about how many obstacles there are, whether it's the trains or whether it's getting the, you know, trying to shift from petrol to something else. You're reminded that there are still a lot of problems being needing to be ironed out if this is going to actually have a lasting effect once the circus has moved on. It might look good for everyone for 2 weeks if there's a good outcome from COP. But what happens then? I think that's the problem. Do they have the wherewithal to make this a lasting effect in Scotland as well as around the world?
And what about you, Pip, from an environment and transport perspective? Do you think we will learn lessons that have been shown up to us in the run up to hosting such a large event? And do you hold that much hope for the conference itself? From beyond the political bubble.
I guess I hope that we'd learn some lessons from it, and you know, it'd be kind of silly if we didn't. In terms of what we're hoping for from COP26, it's really hard to say. You know, that was one of the questions that we were asking people when we were out on the road, you know, meeting folks, and people had, you know, they were hopeful, I guess I would say. They were hopeful, but skeptical at the same time. I think a lot of people just think it's a lot of men in suits that are going to be in a big room. Will they be able to get on? And you know, will something really, really productive and really world-changing come of it? I'm just not sure.
Excellent. I think that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to Rachel, Andy, Pip and Scott, producer Marvin, and of course to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more, but until then, and even after, pick up or log on to The Courier, The Press and Journal, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio!
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshie today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshie or follow Stooshie Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.